And I'm just going to ask you your name and where you're from.
Yeah, my name is Delbert Hayward. I'm from Mount Catlin. Originally, Mount Catlin.
And some questions about where you're from. So is your community big?
It's population-wise about 4,000 people. I would say it's grown about double to three times what it was when I was a little boy.
And were you born in Metlakatla?
Yes.
You were born in Metlakatla?
Yeah.
So there's a clinic or?
Yeah, there's a clinic there. There was a, I don't know what they call it now. There was a woman there that they got a name for.
A midwife?
Yeah, a midwife. Yeah. And that was Bob Nelson. He served probably a lot of us in the world.
And I read somewhere too that Metlakatla is a reservation.
Yeah, it was Father Duncan had gone over, I think a mission in a class one time, had gone to Washington, D.C. to get that island, Sunnet Island. So it's through a congressional act that he got it. And it's called an Inlet Island Reserve.
To my knowledge, that's the only one in Alaska, is what they're saying?
I think so. I'm not sure, but I think there was one in near Anchorage there. But I'm not certain.
I was wondering too, like, since it is a reservation in Alaska, do you think that had some effect on the cultural aspect of losing your culture?
Well, the fact that we came over more isolated us from, isolate our people of trying to recover the culture because they're on the last side. Early days, it was more difficult to travel back and forth because a lot of them, was either rowed or sailed. I remember that we used to do that a lot, going to our various camps. There was very few people had outboards and power boats. So I imagine back then, maybe 100 years before I was born, that was even more so then. They had canoes and things like that, rowboats. But they did travel by, used to sail a lot on these little boats. And then we used to use that quite a bit for them. Mm-hmm. Pretty fast sometimes.
So your family isn't originally from Annette Island or the coastal, I think you said, or the Canadian side?
Yeah, that's where my people originally come from, is the Canadian side, British Columbia. But, just on the outskirts of Prince Rupert, is a place called the old metal cat.
Are there still people residing in the old metal cat?
Yeah, they're still there. And, there's another place called Port Simpson, right? Not very far from there either. It's even fit to a ferry from Prince Rupert nowadays.
And you mentioned earlier in class discussions that your Tlingit and your Tsimshian, do you identify more with your Tlingit culture or your Tsimshian culture?
Tsimshian.
Tsimshian?
Yeah.
And I remember you mentioned you just found out you were a raven, is that?
No, I'm a killer whale.
Killer whale.
For a long time I thought I was a raven. I would say in the last 5 to 10 years there's a lot of argument on both sides of the family, you know, on my biological mother's side and my stepmother's side. That was really common when we started getting our culture back. There was a lot of mess-up like that. Because, like I say, we didn't follow that. Usually, when you never married into your own culture, I mean your own clan, or you're always married into another.
Opposite.
Yeah, opposite. One of the other three.
I know for the Tlingit culture, you follow your mother. Do you follow your mother?
It's the same way, the same
thing.
Yeah.
And you mentioned something about the butterfly clan.
That's kind of a more recent development where, you know, there's a lot of, now there's a lot of outsiders. You know, marry into the Tsimshian side. And so they didn't have a... They weren't a member of any clan, so that's what they used for a catch-all clan for anybody other than Tsimshians to join or be a member of.
So they would get adopted into the butterfly clan, or that's just a clan
that... That's just where, you know, everybody else is. Whether the Tsimshians are put and go, you know, until they're adopted.
So adoption does take place, that you can get adopted to a clan, but until then you're...
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And traditional regalia, you showed us the ones before, your blanket and your vest. Are there tunics or blankets just for men and women, or a certain design?
I don't know. Because when I look, you know, with all the blankets I've ever seen, you couldn't differentiate between a man and a woman. They all wore the very similar looking blankets. I'm willing to bet on that. At some point in time, in the past, that was part of the case.
Because I see throughout Southeast, I would say there are communities that do have men that just wear tunics, or that women just wear blankets, or both.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if that was...
I don't know. That may be true.
What about traditional designs? Are they more elaborate, do you think, now than they were, like, the traditional way?
You know, they perhaps more refined nowadays, you know, like the designs and everything. You know, you look at a killer whale a long time ago and now they look... I don't know, you look at the totem poles, you know, like the Tlingit totem poles, and even the old totem poles. I remember there's a totem pole park in Sitka. They were elaborate, and, you know, when I was in high school at the time, and those were pretty old totem poles that I saw. And, you know, they did a lot of refined work a long, long time ago. You look at their, you know, their carvings and things like that, there was a lot of detail in them. And there is not that much in what I see today, so I think in time it'll happen, you know, it's just like, it looks a lot better now, though. I mean, I've seen some topo work, like that guy, my nephew, does work, and he's constantly studying it, you know, he's followed, he goes all over the different villages up and down the coast between Seattle and Mount Calvary. And you look at his work, it's real detailed now. Like the totem pole that he made for my dad, it's really some beautiful work that he does. And just based on my memory, I would say it's equal to what was accomplished a long time ago.
The books I brought, you can really see the detail in old totem poles, whereas to now I can notice too there's a style change.
Yeah.
But more and more you see people practicing, it's starting to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just amazing that 100 years ago you have something that's so beautiful. I mean, they didn't have that many tools like they do now.
Right.
We have more tools, but our work isn't as elaborate or detailed as totem poles or masks or bowls are.
There are more and more carvers now that are, they're getting better, they're getting a lot better. I grew up with some of them, like the few that we have back home, like Jack Hudson, Stanley Marsden, and Stephen Marsden. They are prominent. And of course, Bowsley.
Boxley.
There's a guy in Bowsley.
Yeah.
Back home too. But that, you know, and I would say among the few that we have there, Boxley is probably he does real good work. Right, so the other ones are not that far behind, which they are. They do a real good work too. And they study a lot. And, you know, it's something that comes with time, you know, in practice. So.
For painting and carving, do you see the traditional colors still being used, or are there new colors added?
It seems that, like when we started our recovery, getting our culture back, like I told you earlier, there's quite a few people that went across or trying to research a lot of the phenomena, trying to follow the old culture that was practiced a long time ago. I'm not trying to stick to that format. But, you know, like I mentioned too, that, you know, there's a lot of stuff that I don't know. There's a lot of practices, I guess. You know, like, there was one time mentioned that, and I don't know why they do it, or what would happen if something like that, you know, when they're moving the totem pole from the place where they carved it to the place where it's going to be put up, or like we did for my dad, there was somebody there, an older person, that said that if you drop that totem pole on its way from where the carving site over to where it's going to be erected, that totem pole is going to have to stay where it fell. So, when they told us that, all of us that were carrying my dad's totem pole, you know, working shifts, it was heavy. And it's made out of a big tree, you know. And it was about 20, 30 guys at a time packing them with a big 4x4 timber awnings, and four guys on each side, you know, and we had about five or six of these under the pole vault. So yeah, you know, you had thirty guys carrying that pole and making sure, you know, and if it dropped, you know. We were very careful about that. Even while it's being brought up after it's there, you know, if it fell down, it's going to have to stay there.
Did they ever tell you why?
No, see, that's an example of a lot of the old traditional ways that somebody has said, hey, this is what happened if you dropped the tomato. And they didn't know. So we're going to have to find out, you know, there's a lot of unanswered things like that. But it's going to come in time. Well, now, you know, just during my dad's part of life, I didn't even know about this talking stick they mentioned. And they gave it to me. It belonged to my dad. I didn't even know what it was for until somebody mentioned at that potlatch. You know, and I would say the majority of the people there at the potlatch didn't know what it meant. So at the early part of the potlatch, he walked up there and he stood up there and banged that thing real hard on the floor. Nobody didn't know what it was. He just didn't say anything at that time, just bang, 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 three times. And immediately you're supposed to have silence. And everybody knew the culture, you know, they would have done that. They would have just right now kept quiet. They do this for people when they want to get the attention of people, people that want to speak, you know, give a speech or something. Or the guy that's kind of running the potlatch, you know, he'll just go up there. And it looked like a big cane, but it stands about 4 feet tall. And the one I had a raven on it, a carved on the top. And they gave it to me. I was surprised. I didn't even know what it was for until one of my older cousins had explained the function of that talking stick. So that was something new I learned, just that, you know, that was only 4 or 5 years ago. So things are going to have to come about like that.
For your guys' artwork, you guys, I know down there you guys have big timber.
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys use yellow cedar, red cedar?
Yeah, yellow cedar is the favorite for totem poles because it lasts a long time and withstands a lot of the weather and then, I think red cedar is also used.
I know from my own personal experience with carving, I like to use yellow cedar too. The red cedar isn't forgiving when you do a mistake because it's softer than the yellow cedar.
Yeah, that's probably the reason. You can do a lot of finer work, finish work. It's a little denser grain. Red cedar is usually used for, we use it mainly for shingles, to make our own shingles, campsites, siding, and
that
one
splits good.
Yeah, it's real straight. That's the main reason. And it withstands the weather as well. You know, it lasts a long time.
The yellow and red cedar too, my teacher told us they're a natural bug repellent too.
But
that's especially good for totem poles, just reading about.
In the shipbuilding, yellow cedar is used for that reason because it keeps a lot of that bugs and this kelp and it grows on the boat and it's living in the water. And barnacles that keep that off and
the worms that get inside the plankton that is
take inside if you use other than yellow cedar. Your plankton won't last as long. That I learned from the boat building trade.
Do you see any similarities between Tlingit, Tsimshian, and Haida, Northwest Coast Art style?
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities. The actual, there's a basic format that seemed like all the three different tribes follow as far as the potlatches go, but then they customize it, you know, to their particular tribes. The same way up here, you know. There's a lot of things that we did down Metcalfe, they do down in Minto. You know, I looked a lot of their potlatches up here, and there's a lot of similarities. 50-50, you know, it's a lot of differences too.
The masks, I have a picture in here about masks, and I was wondering if you knew the significance of masks. Like, was it to portray your clan or a person?
That's, yeah, a lot of the masks are like yeah, the wolf and the bear and the eagle. All the, you know, all the clan masks. Yeah, they're, you'll see, this is some of them look like headgear. Actually, they're worn on top of the head, some of them. You know, and then they've got others. In fact, I seen one where the jaw on one of them was moved. Yeah, the person wearing had a like a string or something on the side and make it clap, you know. And the same way with the raven or the eagle. Mm-hmm. And they make the bill snap like that.
So some of these would be like headgear,
yeah,
as opposed to a mask too.
Mm-hmm.
Some would be worn atop.
Top head, yeah.
Because I noticed just going to a celebration, I love the Haida and Tsimshian masks. They have more elaborate, bigger ones,
mm-hmm,
just like how you said the bill or the mouth will move.
When I was in high school, my classmates that came from Huna would tell of there was like a bidding contest at some of these potlatches, usually among the skippers of the fishing boats, you know. Down southeast, you make a lot of money from fishing, particularly way back then, you know, so it wasn't uncommon to, you know, to see $100,000, $200,000 in one season by one boat. So when they'd have a potlatch where they bid on this mask, I know they did that in Huna, I don't know, you know, but they had a bidding among the captains for this mask, and they said that one time that one mask went for $30,000. I don't know why they did that, you know, it wasn't explained to me why that happened, but I would assume there was something prestigious to have that mask. And the higher the bidding, the more value, you know, it seemed. You know, they might have it, I don't know what the guy did with it, you know, what he does with it. And he might give it back, or he might sell it at some future, you know, potlatch. I don't know.
But some of them are pretty old.
I know just learning about other cultures, particularly up this area, you would only use the mask for that one ceremony and then it would be burned.
Well, I heard of that.
Or
no,
put in the
wood. No, now that you mentioned it, I didn't think about it. Yeah, I remember hearing that. There's other things up here, like in Minto, and they have a memorial potlatch. They make a song. And it's usually in a memorial potlatch for somebody that they're going to see the final farewells to. You know, that's the reason why they have a memorial potlatch. They say their final goodbyes. Could be a year, 3 or 4 years later, right? After the person dies, you know, but they have the memorial potlatch. And they'll have a, what they call hitting a stick. And they'll make two sticks, probably the size of this. The person that's giving the potlatch will get the stick. And they write a song, and the person beats the... it's like a drum. And you got to hold it a certain way, and you got to have these gloves on. They're all beaded, and you have to hold it a certain way. I think they stuck it out from this side. And everybody that's in that clan that's going to participate in putting on that potlatch, you know, have to learn that song. And they say the potlatch lasts for 3 days. They'll sing that song every day. At every three times a day. And once on the final day, when they'll sing that song, is when they have the giveaways. That's be the final day of the potlatch. And once that's over, then that song's never used again. But somebody's gonna have to write a new one. The other thing that happens is that if somebody writes a song, and some of them are really old, and the people down there in Memphis, they'll sing. Everybody knows, and the whole village knows these, some of these songs that go back up to 100, maybe 150 years ago. And they're just short, very short songs, but they tell a message, you know. And everybody grows up learning these songs in their own generation. Keep it going that way. Just keep passing on. And they'll probably sing about, everybody seems to know at least 20 different songs. You know, they're all sung in Athabasca. But I don't think, you know, nowadays, I don't think anybody knows what they're singing. But they know the words. Until somebody, an old timer that knows the language, can explain it to them. Because that's what happened to me when I was, when I learned my wife's, she put on a memorial potlatch. I didn't know what the heck I was saying, but I memorized it. And just, I don't know how to speak or know what I'm saying. But what they do have there is somebody, an old elder that will teach you the song. We'll go down a month, maybe a couple of weeks before the potlatch starts, and learn that song. They'll put it on tape like this nowadays. But then you'll just practice it over and over and over and over until by the time you get to the potlatch, everybody kind of knows it real well. And now with the guidance of an elder, they'll lead the song and make sure, you know, she sings loud enough that everybody follows along. And by the end of the potlatch, everybody pretty much knows the song real well. You hear them make mistakes or die off, and the old elder would pat one was singing by herself or himself. And everybody just kind of, you know, kind of lean on that person, because usually that person that's leading it is the writer of the song. Let's say once the potlatch is over, that song is never used again. Although when somebody, like I say, when somebody writes a song other than a memorial potlatch, and it gets carried on by, you know, generation after generation, if somebody wants to sing that song, they have to get the permission of the writer. Or the family. It's an old one, it's, you know, the family, descendant of the family.
Do you see that in your culture too?
Well, you know, we don't know, because our culture's been
coming back.
Yeah, it's been missing now for, I would say, 4 or 5 generations. There's a big gap there. A lot wasn't known about our culture. So by the time we come along, it was completely gone. You know, we hear stories about it, but, you know, other than that, it just wasn't practiced. But now, listen, some of these older people, like my parents, grandparents, they said, hey, it's time to get it back. See, they had a lot of respect for that missionary. Whatever he said, and he commanded the village with a pretty strong upper hand, you know. And what he ever said, you know, whatever he said, worked for life. He's like a dictator. But so he did a lot of good, just that I didn't like, you know, when I look at it, I don't like the control he had over the people. But, you know, that happened all the time. Especially when the religious people, like, they come in like that, kind of impose their religion on the they did that all over the world. That's just the way they are. You know, push our culture in the background. But a lot of times, they get mixed together, the religion and the culture. You see that down in India. Highly religious, you know. That village is Episcopalian. In a lot of places in the Southeast are either Presbyterian or Catholic. And you see the mixture there, depending on where you come from.
I see that too, just from my mom, her upbringing. They were all about church too, with her mom. They're Christian, and my dad, family more into, I'd rather go fishing or hunting. We don't really have a religion. But my mom, that side of family, every time we go visit, you gotta go.
Yeah.
Don't really understand, like.
That's the way it was when we were kids. We had to go because our parents said you had to go, or our grandparents said you had to go. Because it was pounded into them, you know. By the time we come along, you know, we start expressing our own opinions about it. And if we disagreed, we'd let them know. So, I didn't like the idea of them pounding it into it. It was that way when I was a kid, especially in those missions. To me, they went overboard. Had I stayed home and got religion by my parents, I probably would have been a Christian. because I went to the mission, we just jammed it down this whole day, 2, 3, 4 times a day. And then we had, on Sunday we had to go to chapel in the morning, and then Sunday school later morning, and then church in the afternoon, and then church again in the evening, and we had to sing in the choir, it wasn't your choice, it was that you had to do it. And you'd get punished for it if you didn't. So it created a sour feeling for me. And all of us that were there, I remember the church now. But I believe in a lot of what they were taught there. They utilized a lot of it. Practice a lot of it, but I don't belong to any church. There's a lot of good things in it. Just that I just didn't like the way the people had ran it. They thought they were right. They believed what they did was right. I disagree with it. Especially after I turned 40, I just dropped it after that. I didn't feel like I was intrusive to myself or to anybody that saw me or felt like I was lying or anything.
I thought it was interesting that you mentioned that the culture is coming back in Metlakatla, because as far as I can remember, just for people my age, I've always seen it there. I love the artwork, love the songs, I love the drums and everything. Cause I remember going to celebration, it's like, who are they? Like, I knew there were Simshans, but they didn't really come to celebration. But once they came, it was just, everybody loves their songs and their drumming and their blankets. And found out I had family that's Simshan, and always told my dad, it's like, I want to do their artwork. Because everything's so elaborate compared to the Tlinkits and the Haidas. Like, they have the bigger drums and the box one. Yeah. That's what I loved. I love the artwork. I've been to Heidelberg, but I haven't been to Metlakatla. I just like looking at old books and new books, and that's how I read about Boxley, David Boxley. Just the artwork to me was intriguing me, that I always like.
He's way younger than I am.
Yeah, I thought like the artwork for Metlakatla and the culture was still there, but I remember seeing a Simshan for the first time, like, oh, they look like us, So naive, but I love watching the dancers for Metlakatla, because the culture, I think, just in my opinion, is getting there, just from learning about from you and other people, like, love to watch.
Yeah, its recovery is pretty, it's coming back by leaps and bounds, I would say when I compare my generation with all the other Tlinkits and Haidas, we probably in many cases know more about our own culture than a lot of the other ones that at one time were way ahead of us. Even the Athabascans, which weren't bothered that much by the modern culture, they got to practice there, even though they were under restriction in a lot of cases, from their grandparents and their parents' generations. Because of their isolation, they weren't influenced that much by a lot of religions came up here. Mostly Catholics and Protestants, Episcopalians, Russian Orthodox. That's another one. Now down in Bristol Bay and Aleutian Chain.
That's big down there.
Yeah, they're nothing but Russian Orthodox. I went to a wedding one time, first time I ever went to that church. One of my friends got married down there. And you go in their church, there's nothing in their church, nothing. Just a big room. Everybody stands, and their services are real lengthy. They're just, they got, this person got married with what they consider an abbreviated marriage ceremony. And even that was long. And they told me, the only reason I went is because a friend of mine, a real good friend of mine, wanted me to videotape it. I was in there walking around, everybody standing, and they have a lot of ritual. You know, they kneel down, they stand up, they march around there, and up around the altar and back and through the, you know, the audience usually stands. Through the whole ceremony, this guy's brother had to hold a crown over this, you know, I forgot it was his wife or the bridegroom. Anyway, and he just tell you this tired. Nothing's heavy because it's a real gold crown. Because they got a lot of, you know, candle holder and they're just solid gold, you know, in those churches. And a lot of their, you know, like the crowns and all the stuff that the priests wear, very valuable. Old.
So do you feel that the missionaries, like, for religious purposes, was more prominent throughout the coastal area of Alaska?
I think they were all over.
All over?
Yeah. You talk to a lot of kids up here, they were hardly, a lot of them today are hardly religious people. So, but I don't know if I explained my perception of why it happened. I might have, I usually do. It's something that, you know, comes, you know, as you get older and you figure things out, you know. What I thought, you know. And I used to hear about these, you know, through the Presbyterian religion, they had a prayer book, and they selected different countries in the world, Puerto Rico, and all, I mean, wherever they had the Presbyterian church, and they were all there. It's a big, big religion. And I think it stemmed from the fact that there was a guy who was from the same church as Father Duncan, Church of England. His name was Stanley Livingston. You might have heard of him. Anyway, he went to deep in the heart of Africa in the Congo, up the Congo River, and went up there, and the people thought that since he was gone so long, the natives might have killed him. You know? But he came back out, and he converted a lot of those so-called savages. And when he came back, he was just like the Michael Jordan of today, you know, where everybody idolized him. Like all the young people, you want to become like him, you know, and become a missionary. So there was a big drive by all the churches to spread the word, you know. It's like a competition among all the churches. And so they turned out these young missionaries, and they went out to the world, all over the world. A lot of them came up here, in Canada, and Africa, and Asia, and South America. Because like I said, we had these prayer books in all these countries, South America, Europe, India. I knew some Presbyterian, you know, people that went to India, missionaries that went to, was our cook in that mission. She was a missionary in India. And she was there for 30 years. Mm-hmm. She was an old lady when she came and ended up in Ames House as our cook. So we knew about all this, and like I said, every week they had a selected place in the prayer book of one of these places that they prayed for a week. And we sent things to them, you know, food and money, and, you know, we'd gather offerings for a week and would go to these, you know, whoever we were praying for. But that's the way they, you know. Anyway, that Livingston came back, and a lot of those young people were not in the world like that, like he did. And so we had a flooding of missionaries going out there all throughout the whole world, including up here. That was my opinion, the way it all got started.
Just reading about the missionaries and hearing about it from other people, it seems that there were some that, some mission people were more for the good or like better stuff, and there was more that were kind of negative.
Yeah.
And you can see that just throughout Alaska alone, and even lower 48. You hear stories or you read books about the missionary arrival and what it did for the people and what it didn't do for the people. Like, I didn't just comparing it to Alaska, it did seem like it was pretty much the same throughout the U.S., evenly distributed, to where some people followed it and some people didn't. And a lot of the natives, the cultural background was lost when the missionaries arrived.
What I probably primarily didn't like about the way they tried to convert you is and basically a lot of this that we're even when you read about it in the Bible, is they use fear, fear tactics to try to get you to convert over. Like you say, okay, you're a sinner, you're going to go to hell, you know, burn in fires of hell. You know, and that was a scary thing to learn, you know, as a little boy. Lie or you cheat, you're going to hell, you know. And this is the kind of thing that they pepper you with to see your growing years. So by the time you become an adult, you know, you're afraid to do anything wrong. To go against the church. That's what caused me, it took me a long time, you know, to use your, you know, you got reasoning power. Humans do. Animals don't. You know, you're going to, from your knowledge base, you're going to come up with your opinion about anything that you learn. And if somebody imposes, you know, this is what I think happened in religion, is they impose these rules and rules of even thinking on you, and you can't think any other way, you know, or else you go to hell. You can't use Jesus' name in vain or God's name in vain. You know, a lot of people do. You know, Jesus Christ, God damn you, you know, all that stuff, you know. It even today affects me. Training that I had all during my growing up years, I still feel it. You know, when I say, you know, I swear or anything like that, you know, I got guilt. You know, it's not bad anymore. I mean, but see, you're going around, these are the predominant thinkings that you have as you're growing up. And it has a big influence on the way you think and the things that you do. And to me, it was a negative thing in that there was a lot of things that I didn't learn until I put off till later in life because of that. You know, things, the sound, I mean, one of the things that, that really affected me was he used to say that money is the root of all evil. You know, things like that, you know. There's a lot of sayings in the Bible like that. Then I started realizing, you know, a lot of this information is taken out of context. It is, you know, even the way they teach it, they always refer to a couple of verses in a chapter of a book in the Bible. And they'll use it and define it or interpret it like in a sermon or something, the way that particular priest is going to determine. You may not even relate to what they took it out of context in, you know, the story that it came out of. And you interpret it in a different way. But if you read the entire chapter or the entire book, you'll see what that guy was thinking of that wrote that thing. But and every church does that, I'll say. John 3:16, used to memorize all this kind of stuff. And, some churches will interpret one way and another way, you know, that same verse. Or you might interpret it one way and I... So you could see where all the conflict comes from. Why we have so many different churches now. Because some preacher might say, the hell with you, I'm going to go start my own church. So he breaks off, and so you have the Calvinists, and you have the Presbyterians, and you have the Catholics, and so on. This is all what happened during that spread of all the so-called Christians. At one time, there was one church.
No.
You know? But yet, they all use that one Bible. King James Version of the Bible. But, you know, I learned all that, you know, and I pay attention to a lot of it. But like I say, it's like I told you, I think I mentioned it, that truth is not, all the truth is not in that book. It's all around. It's, you know, difference in people, difference in religion, difference in culture, and things like that. The truth. Bits and pieces of the truth are laying all over. So you gotta pick and choose and use, you know. And like I said, all my growing up years, the Bibles are absolutely right. The Presbyterian Church is absolutely right. The Catholic Church is absolutely right. You've got all these conflicts going. But who do you need? So I went on a path of my own, just saying, okay, I'm going to find the truth myself. And that's what I've been doing. I'll evaluate everybody's perception of truth, and I'll use some of it, or I won't use any of it. You know? But I'll listen to, or I'll look at, or I'll read about, you know, other people's opinions. I have to come to a conclusion of my own about what their opinion is. Mine might be in contrast to theirs, based on what I learned. You know. That way I try to verify everything that I learned. I may be wrong. But it's the truth as best as I understand it. Like I said, when I was 40, 45, that's when I shot on. And I imagine that would happen to all these different churches that came along. And this one, you know, from the bottom of them, just kept breaking up, branching out different churches. There are 1,000 different churches that are out there, but they're all Christians. Confusing. The other thing is, you know, you look at other religions, like the Buddhists and Hindus and all them. Those have been around thousands and thousands of years before the Christian religion came out. And I would think just because of that, they would be more right than either. I don't know that, because I haven't looked into it. But yet, just based on the years they've been around, the influence they had all over the Asian countries and stuff like that. And people have lived that way for thousands and thousands of years. Our religion is not even 2,000 years old yet, the Christians. But everything is based on that, you know, you talk about A.D. and it's all kind of centralized on starting from Christ before and after B.C. and A.D.
I never thought of it that way, that it started off with just one church and it branched off. And that does make sense, that people would think, well, the way I'm teaching it's the right way, and next person, I'm going to teach it this way, and I'm going to teach it that way. But never thought of it that way, that it all comes back to Christian people or the Bible. They are teaching the same thing, but with a different style or
different interpretation. So things get changed. There was a little game you used to play when you were kids that kind of depicts that. You sit in a circle, sit on chairs in a circle, and you say something to the next person, whisper it in their ear, just once.
Mm.
You remember that?
Yeah, we played that too.
Okay. You say something to their ear, and then you have to say it. Even if you don't know what they really said, you try to say to the next person what you thought they said. By the time it comes back around, there may be 10 or 15 in that circle. Completely different. If you look at the way all these religions developed, that concept, that little game, it's fundamental to the way probably all these different branches of the Christian religion came along. Or any other religion, for that matter.
We used to do that with Catherine Brown Mills back from the elder, except for it was when we were learning Tlingit. So she'd say like bear or eagle, and we'd have to remember and get all the way back to the first or the person again, and they'll tell them, and it won't even make sense. I remember playing that.
Yeah.
I forgot about that till now. I think that would apply to every culture though. Just like how I know like how to sing songs, but I don't know what I'm singing. It's the same for Tlingit, Tsimshian, Haida. Interior natives, and just the cultural background too. We're only repeating or doing what we were taught. We don't know like what we're saying, why we're doing this, talk when the time comes to do this. Just myself, I know too, like the artwork I do is just from studying it, reading it, going to different workshops and listening to the elders and teaching people myself too. Mm-hmm. I'm teaching people how to draw, and it's just all a learning process about my own culture. Even though I grew up with it, I won't know everything about it. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to learn, and
you all in time learn a lot, but still there's going to still be. It's just like in your school too, when you're going to school now. You're in a formal type of environment learning things. But, you know, the school really never stops. You even get the degree. It just keeps going on. And there's always information pertinent to what you learn here in school that's going to come along later. It's going to add to your knowledge base about the subject matter you had in your school, and it's going to help you understand it from a different perspective. Because every time you learn some new piece of information, say you're looking at this cup, you may first come in contact with it over here, and if you look at it from this side, it gives you a bit different perspective. And that's what additional knowledge does for you. So you enhance what you're learning about this cup. You never see this handle before over here, but yet you, until you get on this side, you didn't know there was a handle there. And that's the way that you get learn more and more about things that, you know, just 4 years that you've understood. You know, at some point, especially near the end, there's learning, you know, more about that cup than you first saw that cup. And then that's going to be part of the puzzle of life, and then, you know, move on to something else. But principally, there's a lot of things that you can learn later on. It's going to be related to this cup. Everything's linked together. There's a lot of fundamentals that tie into something out there. And you're going to see this, and pretty soon there's a, you're going to, when you learn something, there's something in your past that's going to come to mind. It's always happening to me all the time now. It just always expands in the knowledge base.
I think that's what I realized just about growing up. I always knew there was Klingit Hai and Tsimshian.
Yeah.
But to me, I guess I was just naive. I thought everybody was Klingit. But my grandma throwing me into the culture, I got to go to celebration and meet family and relatives that were Haida and Tsimshian. So, it's like learning about different cultures and everything in general, because I see a lot of similarities just from what you're telling us in class and my other ANS classes we're taking. There's culturally, we're all the same, I think.
Yeah.
There's a lot that we all do that's the same, but it's just a different language. And I see that just so much in common with our practices that there are up here. And, myself, I think that the Yupik people are using their language a lot more than our people.